First thing I should say is that, like, I'm sure you hear this all the time, but I first heard of you when you were president of NUS Scotland,
Okay, right.
which is a long time ago, I know.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. Dark days.
It's so my claim to fame for like student politics is far less. Actually, realize it's been 10 years since I ran in a student politics election on a platform of introducing full communism and agrarian reform.
Nice.
Which got me to NUS conference in 2014, and that was not a pleasant one. So,
Yeah, I'm trying to remember which one. Was that the one when Malia won?
no, that was the year after. I got the dregs. I got
Right.
the dregs. I got the last dregs of like all the incumbent
Oh.
Nolsies, and then just like one guy who was kind of okay. I don't remember. Obviously, the first thing we should talk about is the thing that's on the agenda of pretty much every progressive at the moment, which is Palestine. How do you think that left wingers and progressives should respond to the, most people call it a situation, the conflict
Yeah.
in Israel and Palestine?
Yeah, I mean it's an interesting question because I think broadly people on the left in this country I think it's like a kind of consensus position. I think a lot of people here are broadly good on Palestine. There's a few groups that I think have pretty dodgy politics on it. It's certainly not the case that leftists or progressives everywhere are good on Palestine. I'll talk about this in a minute, but for example, in Germany, there's a very strange approach to it that I think is deeply, deeply problematic. I think one of the things I hear people challenge Palestine activists on is why prioritize Palestine over, why are you not out for Yemen? Why are you not out for Kashmir? Why are you not out for Western Sahara or Ukraine or, any number of other conflicts? And I think the last couple of weeks have really underlined to me the extent to which Palestine and the conflict in Palestine acts as a kind of linchpin for right-wing political projects more broadly. Maybe we should be doing more about Kashmir and Western Sahara and whatever else, but you certainly don't see right-wingers going to bat for Morocco in the case of Western Sahara or whoever else. And I think the role that Israel plays, and in terms of in terms of Islamophobia, in terms of geopolitical kind of international conflict, in terms of over securitization, over policing, right wing culture war stuff generally, it's very clear that they see it. The right, our enemies, see Israel as a very central thing to their politics, and I think that is why it's so important that it's central to left-wing politics, precisely because it exists at the crux of so many other issues that it feels, unless we can solve the problems there, all these other things are going to continue to draw strength from them. So I think the kind of key thing that leftists and progressives need to do in response to it is keep it a priority, keep banging the drum for it, and not let it, horrific as this is right now, it will subside. It will likely subside into a kind of, whether you call it a ceasefire or not, the conflict will tone down a little bit, but there will continue to be horrific human rights abuses that are maybe just not as front page worthy. And even in those moments, it's vital that it's on the top of the agenda for the left. And I think the way that we're going to change things is through structures, right? I think I understand the instinct to turn away from electoral politics right now in the UK. What Starmer's been saying has been disgraceful. The other parties are no better, generally. But we need countries in the West to change their position on Palestine. We need them to change the way they relate to Israel's impunity. And unless that happens, I really worry that kind of smaller scale actions will, they might begin to chip away at it, but it's not going to be enough. That feels pretty bleak because I think we're further away from mainstream parties in the West taking good positions on Palestine than we have been for a while. But it has to be the goal. We have to change government positions on it, would be my take. There's lots of other institutions that we can probably more easily change. Trade unions would be the obvious one, and that is starting to happen. There's a trade union in Belgium or the Netherlands, I believe, that just this week announced that they would stop transporting goods bound for the Israeli military machine. And I think that's really vital. That was a massive part of bringing down apartheid, when docker unions played a big role in refusing to unload South African military cargo. So then we need to see that here. So I guess the key thing that we need to do is, even once it's no longer on the front page of newspapers, once it's out of the headlines, keep it a priority, because once this tones down, chances are the situation is not really going to improve. And it is vital.
Quite physically can't, buildings have been bombed, right?
Yeah,
I think it is a very true point. Like, lots of people are saying that I've literally seen people saying before the 7th of October there was a ceasefire. It's like, no, there wasn't. Objectively, yeah. There were 23 years previous to this one, 10,000 Palestinians have been killed. That's not a ceasefire.
Yeah, and I think there's this very liberal approach to violence. You see it in the way people talk about austerity, for example. The outrage over someone smashing a window on an anti-cuts protest compared to a government killing people through austerity measures. And I think if you think of violence only in these really narrowly defined terms, then maybe it's just a semantic thing. But I think that this is the concern I have around calls for a ceasefire. Clearly, there has to be a ceasefire. Clearly, that's an urgent first step. But if you end the bombing in Gaza now, but you continue the siege, you continue the checkpoints, you continue the kind of military-assisted settler violence in the West Bank, you continue the way Palestinian and Arab citizens in Israel are treated, it's maybe a ceasefire in some narrowly defined sense, but it's certainly not peace.
The guns may stop, but the violence continues, yeah. I mean, the guns themselves may not even stop.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the settlers in the West Bank are now all armed. I guess this idea that all of this started on October 7th it's just fanciful. It's so absurd that I can't really believe anyone who's saying it believes it.
No, of course not. I mean, the kinds of people who've been advocating that position have been strong supporters of Israel's, right to occupy Palestine for a very, very long time. So they're very fully aware the conflict has gone for a long time. I think it's a case of, most people in the broader population are not engaged. And so they're saying talking points to try and convince people of that. Keeping it a priority, influencing trade unions.
I think one of the unions that put out the best stuff on it has been the Sex Workers Union, who put out a fantastic statement. Again, the response to that, I think, underlines the crossover between anti-Muslim, Islamophobic sentiment and misogynist, far-right politics more generally. The kind of quote tweets and what they put out were shocking. It's shocking in one sense, hardly surprising in another. I think a lot of the British left is very afraid. People saw what happened to Corbyn, and I think there are, frankly, a lot of people who are not very principled and put the kind of comfort of staying quiet above speaking out and doing the right thing. I imagine there will be journalists looking very carefully at the sort of things prominent trade unionists are retweeting or saying, certainly any kind of statements they'll be putting out. And I guess my take on that would be, there is no way to sidestep that. The way kind of anti-Semitism and the crisis was instrumentalized and weaponized has had the kind of chilling effect that I think it was designed to have, as well as the immediate impacts it had on Corbyn and the Labour leadership. We have to stand up to it, because if we don't, and I say we, the movement in its broadest sense, has to be willing to have those fights, because if we don't, then you know that's the lesson they learn, that they can use whatever nonsense to silence any kind of dissent.
I think that's very, very true. When it's one of those things where I'm not going to pretend that I was perfectly understanding that the whole anti-Semitism crisis at the time was blown out of proportion, because I didn't get that. I never agreed with the idea that Corbyn was, or that he personally said anything, but I was like, oh, well, people seem really upset about this. I guess I can't exactly tell them they're completely wrong. But when it came down to it, it was mostly a media storm. And then there was a whole polling on it, which showed that it didn't move many people's votes.
No.
But listening to what you said, I think it was never really about that. The campaign about IHRA definition was less about shifting votes, and I think it was more about chilling speech, as you say, for exactly this kind of moment. And I think it's not just to do with people being worried sort of personally about, well, I guess it's connected to that, but people worried about losing their jobs.
Yeah.
Whether they work for universities, we've already seen crackdowns on that, or even just commercial employers who are not going to want people to take that kind of stance. And it's had that chilling effect from the sort of bottom up, in that people themselves feel inside they can't say anything, and from the top down. And you're right. I think we have our leaders from the top didn't resist it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to do that now, which is the stance I've very much taken. It wasn't that I wasn't going to say anything about it at the start of the conflict breaking out, but I wasn't quite sure what to say. Like, how do you put things into words that isn't offensive to a group of people that have still suffered a horrific attack? Yeah. And then I saw this great post. I think it was by, I don't know her surname, Alice, podcaster. And she did this fantastic post, just sort of pointing out that, like, if you say nothing or delay and dither in saying something, then even if you feel you're not making a difference, you've compromised your own soul in saying nothing. And I was like, that's really true. And it kind of put it into perspective of, like, this is a genuine moral crisis. And if you just say, well, I can't say anything, then you're not only abdicating your responsibility to, like, Palestinians, you're abdicating your moral responsibility to your own soul, which I guess is a very religious thing to say. But
yeah, I suppose the way I've been looking at this is, like, it is simply, it really is not that complicated.
Right? No!
Global conflicts,
which is what's wild.
Very complicated, and intractable and confusing and hard and whatever. And, you know, for example, what's happening right now, I don't think you need to have a very clearly worked out position on, you know, one state versus two states, what happens to East Jerusalem, or what happens to, you know, settlers who are currently in the West. You don't need a fully fleshed out plan for the next 50 years in order to see what's happening in Gaza right now and say, this is clearly wrong. Clearly nothing could justify this. And I think there's this approach that you get all the time that I think you often see it from from academics sometimes, generally from, like, centrists who are like, oh, I didn't realize you were an expert on global geopolitics, whatever. There's this instinct that tells people that they don't know enough, they don't have the authority, they don't have the right to comment on whatever issue it may be. Right now it's Palestine, but it was COVID beforehand. You'll remember the kind of scoffing from the commentariat about,
what was it? It was hipster analysis.
Yeah, hipster analysis, exactly.
Hipster analysis. It's been 3 years that phrase still lives rent-free in my head.
You know, there are these like liberals who see it as their role to play a kind of Praetorian guard for the establishment in whatever form that takes. And firstly, I find it utterly baffling. I don't know what they think they're getting out of it other than this, like, smug sense of superiority. But the truth is that, you know, the issues happening in Gaza right now are not complicated. And nor do I think what was happening with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party under Corbyn was particularly that complicated. You know, when it came down to it, you had a party that absolutely exploded in membership, massive influx of people. Obviously, some of those people had shit politics, and did and said shit things. And you know, maybe the party could have been better at dealing with it. I think there's stuff going on there, but any approach to what was happening there that saw Labour as the racist party in the 2019 election is just fundamentally dishonest. And the thing that kind of horrified me time and time and time again about this was, look, I'm Jewish. I've suffered anti-Semitic incidents. I've had a tooth punched out my face. I've been spat out on the street. When I was at NUS, someone used to send me almost every day pictures of concentration camp victims. So like, this isn't some like abstract thing to me, right? Like I know what anti-Semitism is, but it is just a nonsense to think that anti-Semitism, or the type of anti-Semitism that Labour supposedly typified, was anywhere near as prevalent, as serious, as widely felt, or as consequential as the Islamophobia coming from the Tory party. And my view has always been, there is no way to protect any one group from white supremacy, which is what it is, that abandons all the others. There's no proximity to whiteness that Jewish people can have that will stop, for example, white nationalists in the States shooting up synagogues. And it just felt like such an extreme betrayal of not just of other minoritized groups that we should be in more solidarity, like we should be standing in solidarity with, but even of any kind of meaningful challenge to anti-Semitism in the way that the kind of pro-Israel organizations and much of the kind of self-appointed Jewish establishment so willingly threw Muslims under the bus, threw Black people under the bus, sided with the most abject and transparent racists it going in British politics. And the example I always think about with this was like, they named a settlement after Trump in Israel. You know,
this, oh God, they did, yeah.
I mean, this was a guy who, I think, was very openly anti-Semitic, very openly whipped up anti-Semitism. And I tell this story sometimes. You know, my step-grandparents were in the camps, and they were, both of them were, you know, the only ones in their families, their whole communities who survived. And they, until the day they died, they had this like pouch of soil from Israel pinned to their wall. And, you know, they lived in North London. And to them, what Israel meant was, it meant a few things. For you know, they remembered people trying to leave Germany and being sent back by British gunships, sending them back to be gassed. And, you know, Israel meant that, you know, the Holocaust could never happen again because, you know, Mossad could just swoop in and assassinate Hitler, or there'd be somewhere for Jewish people to go to. And so watching the ways in which Israel has so explicitly cozied up to the white nationalist far right, this isn't a new thing. You know, they were the biggest allies apartheid South Africa had. It just feels like such a horrendous, sickening betrayal of what the Zionist project meant to people, you know, probably not really of my generation, but of the generations before mine. And
thank you very much for sharing that. That was very powerful. It was a reminder of. I still think people conceive of the Holocaust as a historical event on the level of like the Seven Years' War, and not on the level of something that happened to grandparents.
Yeah,
and it's. I think, yeah, I think it is important when talking about the subject to remember why people who are Jewish have such an attachment to Israel and the idea of Israel, and that, like, I suppose I should take this moment to emphasize that I'm talking about like the actions of the Israeli state, right, as indeed are you. But I very much understand why people feel that way. Regarding Trump and Israel, I remember, because I think Netanyahu was prime minister during Trump. He's been prime minister almost continuously, and apart from that brief unwieldy coalition, I think. I was baffled to see him teaming up with Trump, teaming up with Netanyahu, and being praised by him, and liberals in the US just not connecting the dots between why Netanyahu and Trump would be such big buds.
Mm.
And it's because they have the same politics.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And we're like being asked to, someone's made the point, basically, that we're being asked to give a blank check at the moment to a government that's headed by, effectively, the Israeli version of the National Front, with ministers who are like to the right of that. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what's... Yeah.
I mean, this is a point I often make to people, is that obviously the occupation is central to the state of Israeli politics more generally. But if you were to completely, if you were just such a like an anti-Arab racist that you just did not care about the occupation at all, you don't consider it in any respect, and say it doesn't exist. Israel is one of the most far-right, theocratic, like fundamentalist governments in the West. And for people to act like it's just some like normal country I think it belies like how superficially they engage with it. And but you know, the protests over the judicial reform, for example, even within Israeli public society, it's very clear that, you know, Netanyahu is extremely unpopular at the moment. There's huge opposition from the kind of like liberal center to his government's project. And the thing that drives that home for me the most is consistently Haaretz, which is, you know, it's like the Israeli Guardian. You know, it's not far left, it's probably center left, but it's a pretty mainstream, respectable paper. They consistently, over the last 3 weeks, have been saying things that, for instance, would get you expelled from Keir Starmer's Labour Party. And it's so illustrative to me of how detached from the actual the concerns of actual Israelis, you know, working class people in Tel Aviv. Governments here don't care about that. For all this talk about Israel's interests, what interests are they talking about? It's not the interests of like ordinary Israelis. It's obviously not the interests of Palestinians. It's not really the interest of the Israeli state, because the way Netanyahu is, you know, I think he is creating some very extreme existential challenges to Zionism as a project. For instance, driving away the support of diaspora, young diaspora Jews, which is crucial to the project's survival. So whose interest is it? Not to be kind of conspiratorial, because it's quite obvious. It's arms companies, and it's global white supremacy, and it's neocolonialism, and it's all these things. So it really sticks in my throat to see people like Keir Starmer or David Lammy or even Bernie Sanders.
That was the worst one. That was such a rough thing to see.
He's always had quite bad politics on Israel.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a Jewish man of a certain age. Doesn't excuse
it. Like, I understand, but also, come on, man. So there may be more we can discuss about the conflict, but I don't like to bring people on to just talk about one thing. So I would love to talk to you about rent control, which is an issue that you are deeply involved in.
Yeah.
You're heavily involved with Living Rent, which is a tenants' union. Is it a tenants' union and a campaigning organization? So basically, tell us a bit about it and what it does.
Yes, we're a union, and we're very clear. We do campaigning, but we're very clear that we're a union, not a charity, not a think tank, not a kind of campaign organization. And that has some big like implications for how we do campaigns, which we'll come back to. We set up just under 10 years ago. Crazy to think. And initially, it was the government were doing this consultation on a new bill. And we recognized that landlords were going to be organizing to respond to it. We needed to as well. We built this big coalition around three basic demands: increased security of tenure, increased flexibility of tenure, and increased affordability, by which we meant rent controls. And over the years, we've had kind of huge successes on some of those like policy initiatives that we've been campaigning on. So we got no-fault evictions which is called Section 21 down south. We got those abolished. We got short sure tenancies scrapped and replaced with a new, better, though still flawed, form of tenancy called private residential tenancies. We've been doing a lot of work, particularly in Edinburgh and the Highlands, around short-term lets, like your kind of Airbnbs. I've got a new kind of licensing scheme and things in place.
Yes, I saw the landlords are very, very, very angry over it.
They're very upset about it, yeah. During COVID, we got a ban on evictions. We secured just last year an emergency rent freeze. The government are now about to introduce rent controls. As well as those kind of big government level campaigns, we've won, I reckon, probably in the hundreds of thousands in repairs and compensation for members in what we call member defence cases. We've got councils, you know, in Edinburgh, where I'm based, in Muirhouse and Lough End, the branches there, which are largely led by social tenants, have secured millions in ring fence funding from the councils for it. And that's just in Edinburgh. The Glasgow branches are they're bigger. There's more of them. They've achieved also incredible things. And so as an organization, I think, you know, we've punched well above our weight in terms of policy change. And I think that's partly down to kind of stars aligning a little bit. I think the housing crisis just is at breaking point, and we're one of the only organizations representing and advocating for tenants in that. You've got organizations like Shelter, but they don't represent tenants, and that's very clear from some of their positions.
Shelter's opposed to rent controls.
I'll
ask you about that in a second, I guess. Yeah, that was baffling to me.
They're very quiet about rent controls in Scotland. I think they know it's happening, but they represent landlords just as much as they represent tenants. You know, they're not a union, they're a charity, and I've got a lot of criticisms about the way they've approached the last kind of 10 years. But for instance, in the run up to this 2016 Act that we got set up to deal with, they were saying that they wanted to scrap no-fault evictions. That was their key thing. And we were saying, yes, we need to do that, but we also need to have indefinite tenancies so that people can stay as long as they like, and rent controls. And I remember people, not just Shelter, but, you know, the respectable organizations in the sector telling us that, you know, this was a distraction. We were gonna ruin our chances of getting these other changes. And I think they were totally wrong. Not only did we win those things, but I think we secured a political consensus for rent controls that's now translating into that. But just a word on kind of like our approach to things. All of those campaigns and those campaign wins the other kind of like local campaigns that branches have been doing on all sorts of issues in their communities, the member defence cases that we do, the purpose of all of them, yes, the outcome is important. It's important that we win these things. It's important that we change legislation, whatever. But the much bigger prize to me, to my mind, is building the kind of power and infrastructure of tenants as a class in order to fight for and demand and win much bigger prizes. And so there have been times where we've probably sacrificed some of that short-term impact to do the kind of the bigger project of building power in communities. There's been times where funders haven't been particularly happy with how confrontational sometimes we are with protests outside letting agents. There have been times when, you know, we really prioritize training people up and building up people's skills and sending them off to, you know, meetings with members of the Scottish Parliament, for example, when maybe it would be more efficient in some narrow sense to have one public affairs person who has their suit and goes into those meetings and knows how to schmooze. But that's not the kind of organization we're trying to build. And I think that has paid off massively. Not only do we have huge political successes that I think speak for themselves, but, you know, I think of the amount of organizations I've been involved in over the kind of last 15 years that, you know, they go for a couple of years and then they peter out. Living Rent now has thousands of members. We have branches all across Scotland, dozens of branches. We have, God, I've lost count. I think we've got 16, 17 paid staff now. And so what we have successfully done is built this infrastructure that you know, so many left-wing organizations depend on one or two very key people pulling the weight of the whole organization. I think there's no one or two people who can like disappear overnight and living rent fall apart. And I think that's really exciting to me.
Yeah.
Important.
No, that's like fantastic to hear. I didn't realize, by the way, that no-fault evictions have been scrapped in Scotland.
Yeah, we got them scrapped.
We still have them down south. Yes. Literally happened to me. Was not fun.
Yeah.
But that's amazing. Yeah, that's fantastic.
I don't mean to say that things are perfect here.
No.
In some ways, I think landlords understand that they're like fighting back, I guess. And they're fighting back both in terms of the lobbying they're doing to governments, but I think they're increasing rents in ways that they maybe wouldn't otherwise be doing. People are facing are being evicted because of speaking out about this sort of stuff. They're all threatening to sell up, which we can maybe come on to. A lot of it feels to me very much like last ditch attempt to salvage what they can.
Would you like to plug anything before you depart?
Yes. If people are in Scotland, they should join Living Rent. I think all the like bleakness and misery I feel about politics, there nothing alleviates that better than like defeating a landlord and getting justice for a tenant. So if you cannot motivate yourself with hope, motivate yourself with spite and vengeance. If you're not in Scotland, join either London Renters Union or Acorn or various other kind of tenant organizations. I think the tenant organizing that's happening across the UK is vital to changing society. The role that housing plays in like British capitalism and international capitalism is extremely central. The government are doing everything they can to make it harder and harder to organize in workplaces. We obviously need to resist that and continue organizing in workplaces, but it is quite difficult to make it harder to organize in housing because you know where people live. And I quite sincerely believe that there is an opportunity for class consciousness raising in housing just by virtue of how much everyone hates their landlords. And the amount of times we've taken people join Living Rent because they're pissed off about like a repair not being done. And it's about building that agency and consciousness and power, not just as an organization, but for those individuals. That is transformative. And it is a really powerful antidote. As I said, you know, I rattled off all the things that Living Rent has won. We're going to keep winning things like that. The other tenants' unions are the same. It will replenish your soul. Join the tenants union.
That's a wonderful way to end. Thank you so much for coming on, and it has been an absolute delight to meet you person to person. Been a big fan for a long time. Just wanted to finish this by saying thank you to my beloved Patreon subscribers who make my work possible: Mick Mikatir, Joe Bird, Ben, Mohammed Mumit, Duncan Black, Joseph Bailey, Barry James, Neil Barton, Yuditha De Silva, Thomas Alexander, Ruth Holliday, Conrad, Chris Gravel, Patrick Lefebvre, Bert Rothkugel, Stephen Carr, Alex Wilson, and Scott Folan. It is thanks to these people that my work is possible. And if you want, like them, to enjoy the hour-long episodes of Stats for Lefties podcast and other content, be sure to visit patreon.com/leftystats to subscribe from £2 to £5 a month. Thanks again, guys. Love you all very much.